This is Dr. Denise. I'm going to have Kathleen O'Toole on the show today. We will be discussing the newly released book by Dr. Bandy Lee and 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts that assess a president. The title of the book is The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning, Dr. Denise. How are you?
Good. I really appreciate this time we have to discuss these important topics.
Right. You wanted to talk about this month that brought us that new book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, and then several Democrats reportedly contacting the editor of this book to discuss President Trump's mental state. What's your take on all this, Dr. Denise?
Well, I have so many feelings about talking about someone's mental health in a way that doesn't give context to it. So I think as a society, when we are throwing out terms like narcissism, poor impulse control, depression, hypomania, we need to be very mindful that we need to still continue to change the way we think, talk, and act about mental health. So I'm very passionate about that part of the topic. And we also can discuss the actual book, which is a fantastic book. So, you know, we can go wherever we want to go with this, but, you know, we're at a time in history where we've been gaining such great momentum with people like Carrie Fisher speaking out about her bipolar, the royal family discussing mental health, Lady Gaga. And I just really want to make sure as a society that we stay on path, which means we are realizing that people can have major depression, have ADHD, bipolar disorder, anxiety. In fact, it was really interesting, Kathleen, in the book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, one of the astute clinicians brought up the case that before 1974, of the 37 acting presidents, 50% of them had mental health issues, depression, anxiety, and so on, or possible. These are psychohistorians that looked back in
data.
Which
I didn't know there was a thing like that. But
there's something called
interesting to people.
There's
right.
Something called the psychohistorian, which we don't. So I just want to say that there's been data gathered that thinks that, you know, half of the presidents before 1974 had some mental health challenges. And even notice, everyone, I'm saying mental health challenges, because we have to remember if someone has asthma or diabetes, or we have, you know, current senators with brain tumors, we have to remember that being human means we're going to have physical and mental health challenges throughout our life. So that doesn't
right.
necessarily mean that we're in a dangerous situation to practice medicine, practice law. There are many successful entrepreneurs in the world that have ADHD and bipolar. And there's many people, there's, you know, the word narcissism is being overused right now. There's a level of healthy narcissism that people have just to exist and get up every day. And so I think what happens, Kathleen, and you can really appreciate this because you've, you know, been a part of the news in your career, that the linear language, when you just hear little mini sound bites, can come across very terse and kind of unkind, very unkind to individuals. So I just wanted to start with those thoughts and we can go where we're going to go with this discussion.
Well, do we think that, like, many, many people are kind of playing, like, whether it be with the executive office or with the neighbor down the street who annoys them, are many of us playing, like, armchair psychologists, psychiatrists? And if we are, like, what kind of disservice are we doing to people with mental health challenges?
Well, I think the one thing I want everyone, you know, for us to remember is that everyone has the right to their opinion and the freedom of speech. So okay. I want to make sure that's clear. And yes, I think right now people are angry. They're fearful. There's so many mean and unkind things going on daily that are, it's just ramped up. Society is in a fear factor stage. And I think people are throwing out words out of fear, much more so. You know, maybe you can comment. Have you ever in all your time being part of the news and this greater audience ever heard the level of discussion that we're having right now about narcissism and mental health issues and doing it in an unkind manner? Have you ever heard it to this level?
No, it just seems like it's like we as a society have created this climate where it's okay. You know, I'm not sitting on one side of the aisle or the other. Like everybody, it's not even political. It's just like permeated the fabric of society where we're using these terms. And, you know, I didn't go to medical school. I can't diagnose, you know, bipolar or, you know, it used to maybe be that oh, he's crazy. And, you know, you kind of knew that you shouldn't use those words. But now that you have these medical terms, you feel like, oh, I can throw these around a bit, right? And no, I have not seen anything. I just see an escalation of where it's okay, everyone to just not be kind to one another.
Right. And I think one thing to remember, because I am wearing the MD hat in this lifetime, is that from an ethical perspective, I just wanted to say that in 1973, there was the Goldwater Rule that says that prohibits psychiatrists from offering a professional opinion in public about the mental health of anyone not personally examined. Okay, so we've got the Goldwater Rule. And right. In the spring, the president of the APA, American Psychiatric Association, reminded everyone sort of like, remember this. And I think one of the big things that I loved about the book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which Dr. Bandy Lee of Yale, who was the organizer of the Yale Duty to Warn Conference, helped, you know, really produce, is that the clinicians talk that there's actually a professional opinion versus an opinion of a professional. And when I was at the APA meeting, I went to this discussion with all the top thought leaders. I made sure I went in San Diego, and people were talking about, yes, we have our professional ethics to not go against the Goldwater Rule, that we shouldn't be diagnosing Donald Trump or anyone without examining them. So everyone overall agrees with that. However, where are we as citizens and our own opinion about how a world leader is behaving? Are they dangerous? Are they fit to lead? Not diagnosing them. And then it's really, really important to remember that we've got the 1973 Goldwater Rule, but then we've got the 1976 Tarasoff decision. And so all the doctors and astute clinicians in the book...
Explain to people what the Tarasoff decision is.
I'm about to. So basically, psychiatrists have a positive obligation to speak out publicly when they have determined that an individual is dangerous to another person or persons. And so let's say if this was done in an individual case where someone's right. patient really was very homicidal towards someone else, and there was the duty to warn that overrode the patient-doctor relationship, confidentiality. And I actually am just going to share a real personal story. There was someone who, when I was at Emory University, someone who was upset that they didn't get admitted. There was a lot of malingering, and they went to three different hospitals, and my maiden name was Czech. This man really wanted to kill me. So I had doctors and attendings like duty to warn me. Like that was part of his psychiatric assessment. And so the patient doctor confidentiality was overrode in that situation because of the Tarasoff. So just for everyone to know. And so in this brilliantly written book, there's a amazing point that the Tarasoff overrides the Goldwater Rule from a clinical and legal standpoint. Now we have a different situation here. The doctors who are writing and being a part of this duty to warn book and such are really making the case for dangerousness and saying we are not going to diagnose Donald Trump. They say that very clearly. And they give qualitative examples, because in the world of how do you profile someone, there's psychiatrists and psychologists that have been asked to work with the government throughout history. How do we profile Sedan? How do we profile different people? You know, it's this kind of profiling happens within the FBI and within many different areas. And so in this book, they're really talking about the dangerousness of someone to be fit cognitively and to act in a very cautious way and not impulsive. And so I think that back to your question, you know, how do I feel about these armchair diagnoses? I think society is kind of out of control with it because people are living in fear. You know, when you're constantly hearing about the threat of nuclear war every day, when all parties, Democrats and Republicans, are spewing unkind, nasty remarks to one another, you know, it's almost like it's given everyone permission just to diagnose or to be mean. And I think, you know, I'm going to let you speak now because, you know, as mothers and also as a doctor, I have very strong feelings of how we can provide a framework and a nice discussion to our children about these topics.
Well, I mean, I've heard a lot of mothers and fathers say, well, I don't even let my children, like, you know, partake in anything other than they try to control everything a child hears, which I think is a little bit naive, a lot of it naive, in terms of not letting them even listen to politics or listen to, you know, but how, where does that end? Because that, it's not, politics is just kind of a mirror to our society, right? It's
correct.
Not just these big bad politicians up there in their rounded house. It's all of us, the way we, you know, speak to each other, or, you know, I mean, the examples go on and on, and who needs personal examples, but like it, yeah, how do you tell your children when they're not seeing adults? They're not, in many cases, the children are acting like adults.
Apps.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Do I make that clear? Yeah.
Yes. And so I'm going to go for it. I'm going to give an example. My 8-year-old, who I would have never thought would have been interested in watching some of the debates, sat there and watched mm-hmm. some of the debates with us. And I think it's very important for all of us as parents to meet our children where they're at developmentally. When things come up on television, we have to talk with our children. And that's what I do with my son. I really, you know, when I have people visiting from other countries, you know, we just had Lama Tenzin here. We had a monk visiting. I had him do some YouTube. So my son's getting exposed to a lot of unique situations. We were watching the presidential debates. And on election night, I could never imagine that my son would come up to me. He had tears strolling down his cheeks. He said, Mom, if the nuclear bomb goes off, will I see you in heaven? And we had to turn off the debates. I took him upstairs, and I went upstairs, and my husband continued to watch it, everything on election night. And I explained to him what democracy was, and that, you know, we really have to have hope and faith in the United States of America, that we're going to have elected officials and that we're going to make good choices, and that this is why America is such a great country. So I spent that time doing that with my son. So this speaks to your point. My son had been exposed to the debates. He had heard what different people said, and he was living in a place of fear. And I, you know, as a mom, I don't really regret that he watched the debates, because that's what I thought he could handle, and he could. And, you know, I know how to talk with him about this stuff. But that's a big, big weight for a child to have to think about. So I think your point about how to talk with our kids is a very important one.
Right. I do think, unfortunately, that worry that your son had and maybe still has is something that's not new to this decade. That's a decades old worry for children because of what's happened in the world. The vitriol and the lack of civility, maybe it was like going on like quietly behind the scenes before, but it's full on out there now, right? And that vitriol and lack of civility is just, you know, how do you counter program against that with our little kids?
You know, that's actually an interesting point. So a couple things. From a brain development standpoint, there's the prefrontal cortex, which is the CEO of the brain, that after age 26, most adults are very much more logical. They're not as impulsive and acting from just an emotional fear factor amygdala. There's a myelination between different parts of the brain that allows someone to make more sophisticated, cautious, non-impulsive decisions. I feel like what's happened in the last year is everyone's been given permission to sort of say whatever they think. Like, you're getting a running commentary of, I don't like this person does this. So freedom of speech has gone to freedom of speech and you don't have to be kind. So I think society's shifted. And what's happening too, Kathleen, is I feel like society is getting traumatized every day. And also there's a sense of learned helplessness, where people are desensitized, like, oh, yet another day of discussion of nuclear war, and yet another day of someone saying
it's
someone's
a mass shooting.
Another, right.
Yeah, yeah. So there's this desensitizing that we're going through, and do we see an end in sight? I mean, like, are we circling the drain?
Well, you know, this is where I think we all need to take personal responsibility for our unique family life, work situation, anything we can do on, you know, to politically, for the greater good of our United States of America, to make sure that we have elected officials, if there's elections coming up, that we don't just lay down. You know, it's really easy to look at the news and almost just tune out and never look back and don't watch it. So I think we need to strike a mindful, neutral, healthy balance, still allowing ourselves to get angry and be fearful, but then shift it into something positive. So what I think for our children, and I think at each household, is we have to decide what quality and quantity of news and information. We don't need to avoid it, but we need to come from a place of empowerment. And so, for instance, with my now 8.5-year-old, we do things like donate to charities. He knows that mommy, we talk about kindness and what can we do to help other people. So,
He has great kindness programming at a school too, doesn't he?
Oh my gosh, it's fantastic. They have acts of kindness awards. It's all over the school. In fact, each hallway in the school, there's something like trustworthiness, responsibility, and they have a kindness rock garden. And so it's integrated into the mindset at my son's elementary school, which I think, and I wanted to bring this up to everyone, I strongly feel that mindfulness and kindness integrated into our schools, into our homes, into the news is something that will help to shift things so people don't have to feel like they're just going to lay down. Now, will this take away, you know, all the anger in society? Absolutely not. You know, we're animals at the end of the day. But I think the other part of it too is, I love the word neurostyle. Right?
Right.
I want to discuss the neurostyle word that we all process and perceive information in our own unique way. So if that is taught in preschool and that is taught in our schools, like let's say if someone's having learning issues, attention issues, moodiness, shyness, fear of germs, that people don't have to be associated like there's something quote unquote wrong with them, or the use of the word disorder is really one I can't stand for. People know this. The word disorder for me, I've written a blog, is like nails on the chalkboard. I value science. I value my Western medicine training. However, my understanding of holistic mental and physical health is that the words we choose, the thoughts that we have, and the actions we take influence our health. So if we're using words like neurostyle, or a person has learning challenges or issues, instead of that person's mentally ill or crazy or, oh my God, that effed up person, or that person with their depression, you know, I think society is just throwing out terms. And, you know, for all the successful people, oh my gosh, my practice, I see 60% children, teens, 40% adults. Some of the most powerhouse people in the world have depression, ADHD, hypomania. And they are thriving. They are incredible members of society. People with autism spectrum issues, incredible. So many engineers in my practice have autism spectrum issues, but they have families. They've worked really hard. And I am not taking away the validation that people need when they are feeling like their mental health challenges are creating an illness or a sadness or disorder in their life. I validate that. I value a way of discussing it. But the linear language just doesn't do us justice. So now the way words are being thrown around in the media, so is everyone that's ever had some narcissism or impulse control problem supposed to now be like a walking freak? I don't think so. And so, I even use that word, which I don't even like that word, just to make a point. That is a harsh term, you know? So we need to be mindful. I do think that people... In my profession, I was very upset when I felt like we were getting tisk tisk. Don't talk about anything in politics. That's how it came across this spring.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like way to go, Dr. Bandy Lee, for having, you know, the wherewithal. And she's an activist and very much concerned about the greater good of humankind. So I think that this book was very clearly written to not diagnose, but for people to stand in their truth and power, that are psychologists and psychiatrists on the data that we have from looking at hours of footage and everything on the current acting president. And one, there's a couple important points that were made, that one thing that we have a problem with as a society is we do not, this is back to sort of when we have different neurostyles leading the presidential office, we do not currently have a level of what's the current cognitive level that an acting president should have, and what is their ability to make non-impulsive, cautious decisions. We do have sort of the honor system that any incoming president is medically and physically stable, but we don't have a mechanism put into place, which was eloquently discussed in this book. Much like if, you know, the Supreme Court, we don't have something that's like a group of clinicians and highly ethical professionals to help weigh in that have been voted in a democratic way that society agrees on. And so we don't have something put in place if indeed, I mean, we do, I guess we can say that the government does, the ability, maybe you can talk about the 25th Amendment. We do have something put into place, but that's super complex, right? Because then that becomes more political than taking kind of a nice, oh, what's the greater good for democracy? And so the current system sets no intellectual or cognitive standard, and this is an absolute vulnerability at this time in history. And by the way, I feel like it has been, you know, there's been other past presidents that were having dementia during their presidency, and they didn't come forward saying, you know, I'm losing it cognitively. So this isn't new, this idea of is someone a danger or not to be in a public office. I think that there's been other times in history.
Right. But I think what many people from both sides of the aisle would say is once you get some sort of council of doctors or psychologists together, then it has to become political. From its inception, it's politics. And even talking now about the need for one is, you know, it reveals a political underpinning. There's going to be a lot of people who feel that way.
Of course. So this isn't a situation, you know, that we can solve overnight. But I do think we do not want to be diagnosing people when we haven't met them. Or if we do, we need to qualify it with, I'm feeling, I know I'm not a doctor, or, you know, of course, in your own home, you're going to say what you want to say. But we really need to remember, when we're talking about a world leader, we really want to feel safe. We want to feel secure. We want to feel like they can make decisions that aren't impulsive. And so for anyone saying armchair diagnoses, you know, go for it. You have freedom of speech. However, remember, when you're doing that, there are millions of people out there that have mental health issues, and people don't want to be lumped into categories. Just because I have this blah, blah, blah diagnosis doesn't mean I'm not going to be exceptional in my ability to function as a parent or as a world leader, that people can have certain neuro styles and exceed. One of the titles in one of the chapters of the book is called Unbridled and Extreme Present Hedonism: How the Leader of the Free World Has Proven Time and Time Again He Is Unfit for Duty. And so there's many different discussions on the ability of a person to have cognitive stability and in the moment not be impulsive when you're making decisions that can affect our entire planet. And there's a lot more. You know, I don't want to overly focus on that. I really wanted to mostly focus on, you know, you and I've had discussions about quote unquote the land of the mean, and how do we as a society not get traumatized every day by the words and the scenes that we see on the news and in social media in our homes and everywhere.
Right. I just, before we move on from the book, I have like a gut wrenching problem with, you know, and this is just my personal opinion, but I have a gut wrenching problem with diagnosing people without really sitting down with them. And I feel like it's just, I don't know. It doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for what I believe in. I don't even think you could do it. Even if you tried to do it, if I even agreed, okay, that's an okay thing. I don't think you could do, I don't think one could do a great job, because I feel like what you see on the media and with little, 67 word snippets could be a complete, it might not be an insight into the mind at all. It could be a complete performance, you know? I mean, I just don't, I think that what a doctor and a patient does in an office is very special and sacred. And I don't think, I think that I understand that everyone needs to feel safe and secure. Gosh, I want to with my world, my community and my planet. But it does trouble me that someone would, what if someone did that to me? You know, boy, Kathleen, she's a Looney Tune. Did you see what she posted? I know it's a very different.
Well, so how was that for you? No, it's not. So how was it for you when you were actively doing the news? How did you feel when they discussed things? How did you handle that? Because I know from knowing you that you're very,
when they discuss things about me,
mental health,
or when
mental health issues. Did you ever cringe when you heard certain taglines, or how was it for you when you were in that environment daily?
So I think what I saw was more of an absence of contemplation about mental health issues, an absence of how a character in whatever news we were covering, how the mental health issues might be playing in for that character. There was some consideration of the news consumer, and whether it be a young person or a squeamish person, with different neurostyles, there was more consideration given than the people who actually became parties of the news. You know what I mean? So I guess that's what we're seeing now, right? We're seeing that we're worried a lot about how we feel about everything, but we're not necessarily, well, I guess we are trying to, you know, there's a lot of us armchair diagnosing and all that. But yeah, that's what I saw. I mean, I saw that, you know, here's a guy who did something, locally, he might have, you know, done something, and we didn't often turn the corner and say, oh, well, let's do a mental health sidebar to this. Like what was going on? Oh, he was diagnosed. Oh, you know, how can we help propel the talk forward?
Right. So the other thing I was just thinking about different times in history where there's been school shootings, and then they go back and the child might have depression or autism spectrum issues where they didn't understand social cues. And, you know, that's actually really common too, when people are sort of looking at empathy. What are reasons why people don't have as much empathy? You know, everyone's talking about narcissism and the need to have a world leader that has altruism and the idea of cooperation and not my team's the only team. So there's the narcissistic way of, you know, viewing the world, but there's also people who are on different levels of the autistic spectrum who really think in terms of black and white, the same thing with different formal thought disorders. So we have issues with the ability to have empathy. But when you just made that great point in the news, let's say there was the discussion of the Columbine shooting or one of the shootings, and they're profiling a child or a teen, right? There's not the aftermath where a Dr. Denise comes in and say, okay, everyone listening out there, not everyone that has depression or ADHD or autism spectrum is going to go out and shoot
people.
Is going
to do this, yeah.
Right? Because I have patients now that aren't able to carry a firearm, which just because they have a diagnosis, and they're pissed off because they've never in a million years had any dangerousness or desire to kill someone. But then they've been lumped into this, oh, you have mental health issues, you can't carry a gun. So,
and it probably affects, I'm just surmising here, but it probably affects who they even want to tell this diagnosis to. Like, do they want to tell it to their new girlfriend? Because the girlfriend's like, oh, well, look what someone else with that diagnosis just did over here, right? So they keep some of their challenges to themselves, which can't be helpful from a therapeutic standpoint.
I had someone that wanted to be a Navy SEAL, and I won't say any much more than that, but you know, in my book, I'll just say that they had this desire, but because they had ADHD, they're like, I got to get off my meds. And I think that a lot of the, you know, people in the military, if you have untreated ADHD, you're going to do better if your attention issues are treated and your depression's treated. I don't think you necessarily, you can lump everyone and say you can't be in the military if you have any of these issues. So a lot of people go off to combat off their meds that could, and by the way, I don't think everyone needs medication. If you've been listening to my shows, you know that I'm all about nutrition, mindfulness, health, well-being. You don't just throw people on prescriptions. It's a very big decision. You don't just do that. So I think we're talking about a greater societal issue that people want to have the highest level of mental health, the best and the most stable cognition. They want to love and accept their own neurostyle, and they don't want to be hearing time and time again all these, like you said, it's gut-wrenching, just armchair diagnosing, because it's actually doing a disservice to all of us, not just the people who've been diagnosed. It's actually having society go backwards instead of forwards. And I think these discussions that we're having are so important. And I want everyone to talk to their kids about that too. We need to be very respectful of all different people's levels of suffering, whether they're deaf, blind, have diabetes, high blood pressure, severe asthma, shyness, depression, learning challenges, neurostyles. We're all unique. It would be a very, very boring world if we were all like little robots that acted perfectly. It would just be very boring.
It would be. Was there anything more that you wanted to talk about? I know we could talk all day.
No, I think this is good. I think I will leave you with the one thing that I think I will say this that came up, and this will be for another show. One of the big issues that happened is things started out in a warlike fashion. When you start throwing out terms of fake news, that also is precipitated a level of upset, and everyone started getting on the defense. So I think on top of everything else we've discussed today, that throwing around fake news, have you in all your years in the news had anyone do that to the level that this has been done?
No, this is brand new. We all know that. Yeah.
Right. So I'm making the point that that phrase, fake news, pretty much put everyone more on a battle position instead of as much neutrality. And, we know that, you know, we all have our different way we perceive things. So I think from a societal standpoint, there's many factors that have escalated the current ways that people talk to one another and about one another. And we have to hold ourselves accountable for the words that we speak, the actions that we do, the shows that we watch, and the people that are in our lives. And that is what we need to do. We cannot just have learned helplessness. We cannot just lay down. We need to be better. We need to be kinder. And we need to take action. We can have times to be upset and angry because we're human. But we need to do better. All of us. This is an incredible country. I love the United States. It's an amazing country. And we need to fight for one another. And we need to fight for those who don't have the ability to fight for themselves. That is what we need to do.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. Thanks, Kathleen.
Okay.
Bye. Goodbye.